The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Nation of Islam. Quote, "Let us have the truth in this case, and that speedily. Let us play with all the cards on the table, for the issue involves human life. Let the detectives get right, lest they fall themselves into the grave which they have dug for another. For truth is on the march, and all things hidden will come to light." End quote. Leo M. Frank. Preface to the Secret Relationship series. Quote, "We have no documentable evidence of anti-Semitism on the part of the Temples of Islam movement or Elijah Muhammad." End quote. Arnold Forster, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. In 1991, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, National Representative of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Nation of Islam, NOI, released the first of several volumes in the scholarly series titled The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. This research was prepared by the NOI's Historical Research Department in response to the increasingly vicious calumnies made against Minister Farrakhan by leaders of the Jewish community. Minister Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam hold the theological belief that black people of America are the real children of Israel, and that those who claim to be Jews are in error. Revelations chapter 2, verse 9, chapter 3, verse 9. And have no genealogical or prophetic relationship to the Jews of the Bible. He further states that the Jewish people are among the white historical oppressors of black people, and that the special relationship they claim to have formed with some black leaders is deceptive, exploitative, and deleterious to black independence and black progress. In its 334 pages, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 1, conclusively proved the veracity of the minister's position, revealing that Jews were in fact at the very center of the transatlantic slave trade as slave traders, financiers, shippers, and insurers, and among the leading plantation owners and international marketers of the products of African slave labor, such as sugar, cotton, and tobacco. In the American Civil War, Jews had joined the Southern Confederacy as strategists, financiers, and soldiers, willing to die and kill to maintain black slavery. Further, this information was meticulously researched from texts written by prominent Jewish scholars and historians such as Dr. Jacob Rader Marcus, Dr. Mark Lee Raphael, Dr. Bertram W. Korn, Dr. Abraham Karp, Dr. Herbert I. Bloom, Isaac S. Emanuel, and Leo E. Chiritz, all of whom were also rabbis. Today, the secret relationship between blacks and Jews can be found in the collections of every major academic library, including those of every Ivy League college and university. Since its publication in 1991, the critics of the Nation of Islam have quietly abandoned the persistent mythological claim that Jews were either co-sufferers or innocent bystanders in the Black Holocaust. The second volume of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, released by Minister Farrakhan in 2010, How Jews Gained Control of the Black American Economy, and its companion volume, Jews Selling Blacks, Slave Sale Advertising by American Jews, presented in nearly 700 pages new evidence that challenges and corrects the prevailing interpretations of the history of blacks and Jews in the post-slavery American South. The research confirms that after the emancipation of black slaves, Jews helped create and defend the racially oppressive Jim Crow system in the American South, and were among the leading traders in America's cotton economy. The American labor movement is shown to have had deep Jewish roots and a devastating long-term effect on black economic progress. The Ku Klux Klan and other white terrorist groups were the premier enforcers of white supremacy and had Jewish involvement at every level, as supporters, members, and financiers. The first two volumes of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews contain nearly 1,000 pages of research that uncovers a history of oppression Jews had successfully kept hidden from view. The present third volume in the series, The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, examines a tragic incident largely unknown to most American blacks, but reverentially regarded by American Jews. That incident occurred in Atlanta, Georgia, between 1913 and 1915, and involved a B'nai B'rith leader and factory manager named Leo Max Frank. He was tried and convicted of murdering a 13-year-old Gentile girl and sentenced to die. An unknown posse stormed the prison and lynched him, making Frank reputedly the only Jew ever lynched in America. The case became an international cause célèbre for Jews, most of whom believed Frank was the victim of anti-Semitism. Several books and hundreds of articles have been written on the tragedy, which has now become a central pillar of American Jewish identity. For 100 years, Jews have insisted that the Leo Frank case is emblematic of their history of suffering and victimization in America. Moreover, the case so profoundly affected the relationship blacks had with American Jews that it can be said that, before the Leo Frank affair, Jews were the black man's open enemy. After the Leo Frank affair, Jews were the black man's best friend. Indeed, the Leo Frank case is that pivotal point in black history when the Jews' history of slave trading, ownership of cotton, sugar, and tobacco plantations, Ku Klux Klan terrorism, and Jim Crow apartheid was deliberately replaced with a new narrative of shared persecution, civil rights coalition, and political common cause. Consequently, an honest assessment of the black-Jewish relationship must include a comprehensive examination of the Leo Frank case and its profound effect on both blacks and Jews. Significantly, the Jewish demand that scholars focus on the Leo Frank case history leads to an unanticipated treasure trove of unexplored records and documents that unlock the most confidential operations of the Jews' highest leadership circles. As the Jewish people united in the international fight to overturn Leo Frank's murder conviction, considerable data about their activities leaked into the public record. Information so extensive and so revealing that its very existence is unique in the annals of Jewish history. The Leo Frank case offers a unique window into the thinking and strategizing of the leaders of the Jewish people. Leo Frank was not of the rank-and-file Jewish citizenry. As the president of the Atlanta chapter of the fraternal order B'nai B'rith, he was arguably the most important Jew in the South. Jews considered him as having, in effect, diplomatic immunity within the white rulership of the Jim Crow South, so his arrest, trial, and conviction shocked, offended, and activated Jews at the highest level. White Gentiles and Jews had been intimate partners in Dixie's slavery system, from which they both derived vast riches. They had freely intermingled in the social, political, and economic culture of the White South, but the Leo Frank trial and conviction set up a showdown like no other in Gentile Jewish history. All the major Jewish leaders, in banking, media, clergy, law, business, and politics, mounted a massive operation to free Leo Frank. And the racial ruthlessness of their efforts is laid bare through a massive cache of documents, including personal letters, rabbinical sermons, official reports, interview transcripts, legal filings, and newspaper reports. They tell a sordid tale of purchased testimony, the planting of evidence, racial scapegoating, extreme expressions of racism, financial manipulations, bribery, retaliation, threats to witnesses, and even attempted murder. The case is further marred by the academic world's willful concealment of this damning evidence, a deception that continues to this very moment. From the trial of Leo Frank in 1913 to his lynching 2 years later, records reveal a methodology only hinted at and speculated on by such purportedly anti-Semitic texts as the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, Henry Ford's International Jew, and Martin Luther's The Jews and Their Lies, all of whose theses were undermined not only by an often conspiratorial and outside-looking-in perspective, but also by their lack of documentation and specificity. No other example exists that so publicly pitted Jews and Gentiles in a test of wills like the Leo Frank case. And Jews practically demand that the outside world investigate the case to draw an accurate portrait of the American Jewish identity, how they have suffered and overcome racial and religious persecution. In 2015, Jonathan Greenblatt, the newly appointed national director of the Anti-Defamation League, chose the 100th anniversary of Frank's lynching, August 17, 1915, to announce a major national initiative against anti-Semitism. And in his remarks, Greenblatt invoked the name of Leo Frank multiple times. Without question, the case is the central pillar of Jewish American identity. As we take a microscope to this little-known but highly significant event in Black Jewish history, we first examine the essential details of the crime, seeking the truth as to who really killed Mary Fagan. Next, we unwrap this mystery in such detail that new and powerful truths are revealed that upset the standard narrative. And then we expose the untold story of the Jewish fight to free a B'nai B'rith leader who tried to get away with murder. Introduction. Quote, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." End quote. Martin Luther King Jr., inspired by 19th century minister Theodore Parker. Quote, "What happened to Mary Fagan was terrible. What happened to Leo Frank was even more terrible." End quote. Harry Golden. In 1913, Jim Crow, Georgia, a wealthy and powerful white man was charged with the brutal rape and murder of his employee, a 13-year-old white girl. He vehemently denied the charge and accused two of his Black employees of the crime. He had the finest lawyers in the South and two of the nation's most expensive private detective firms at his disposal. The governor of the state of Georgia resolutely supported him, and the world's most important newspaper vigorously backed him. Yet, at the end of a 2-year ordeal, the white man was lynched by a mob of fellow white men, and the Black men went free. That outcome is unique in American racial history. And so we begin that incredible story. These facts are indisputable. On August 25th, 1913, Leo Max Frank, the Jewish manager of an Atlanta pencil factory and president of the local chapter of the Jewish fraternal organization, B'nai B'rith, was found guilty by a Georgia jury and sentenced to death by hanging for the brutal murder of one of his employees, a 13-year-old white Christian girl named Mary Fagan. For the next 2 years, Frank appealed the guilty verdict 13 separate times, and all the appellate courts, including the United States Supreme Court, upheld the verdict and the death sentence. On June 21, 1915, a day before Frank was scheduled to hang, Georgia's governor, John M. Slayton, commuted Frank's death sentence to life imprisonment, to be served in the state's penitentiary. On August 17, 1915, more than a dozen men seized Frank from the state prison, drove him to the murdered girl's hometown, and hanged him from a tree. He was one of only 3 Jews to have ever been lynched in America. And beyond those established facts, all agreement ends. The trial and aftermath made major waves in the American judicial system when the peculiar circumstances of that trial opened a significant fissure in the very foundation of American white supremacy. Blacks had long been barred from participation in any legal proceeding except as defendants, and their testimony, especially in cases involving the fate of white persons, was simply deemed invalid. Despite those hard and fast Jim Crow laws and customs, Leo Frank became the first white man in the South to be convicted of a capital offense in a trial that featured the prominent testimony of black witnesses. That fact alone made the Frank case revolutionary. The trial placed several of Frank's black employees on the witness stand to contradict directly and convincingly the claims of their wealthy white Jewish employer. By its admission of black testimony, the Frank case could easily have been seen as a major advance in the long civil rights struggle of blacks in America and a bellwether of future progress. Jews, however, did not see this judicial reform as a progressive action at all. The unprecedented deviation from the South's racist norms stunned Jews, causing them to reassess their relationship with their fellow Caucasians and to question whether they too had become vulnerable to the iniquities of American Jim Crow, a system which Jews had helped to establish and from which Jews had derived many, many social, political, and especially financial benefits. In fact, most Jews believe that the acceptance of, quote, Negro testimony, end quote, was a most egregious assault on their rights, that the court's validation of blacks as witnesses was the proof that the white Gentiles had turned their backs on them, and that, quote, anti-Semitism, end quote, was responsible for Frank's conviction. Dr. Stuart Rockoff summarized the Jewish point of view. In the South, white defendants were generally protected from the testimony of black witnesses, or the judgment of black jurors. Yet Frank did not receive this protection, and he was convicted and ultimately lynched based on the testimony of a black witness. Thus, social whiteness for Southern Jews could be provisional and limited. Further fueling this racial bonfire is the aggressive Jewish claim that the actual murderer of the young white Mary Fagan was Frank's own hired janitor, James, Jim, Conley. Conley's impressive witness stand testimony was easily the most damaging blow to Frank's trial defense. These dual insults, the tainting of the moral image of a Jewish leader and the belief that a white Jew paid the ultimate price for the crime of a black man, have haunted and vexed Frank's Jewish advocates for a century. Blacks are far less familiar with the Leo Frank case, even though it is arguably as important to black progress as Plessy v. Ferguson, Brown v. Board, or even Lincoln's 1863 Emancipation Proclamation. The black janitor whose testimony became central to Leo Frank's conviction became the most quoted black person in American history up to that time. More of his words appeared in print in the New York Times than those of W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus M. Garvey, and Booker T. Washington, combined. Most significant, the Leo Frank case influenced critical events in the history of the relationship between blacks and Jews in America. Frank's lynching, quote, became a symbol of Jew hatred in America, end quote, and motivated Jews to build alliances with oppressed blacks, resulting in the fabled and controversial Black-Jewish Alliance. The Leo Frank case gave the nascent Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith its raison d'etre. The ADL would become the main representative body of American Jews and the Jewish organization most aggressively involved in black internal affairs. The Leo Frank case was claimed to be the pivotal event that ignited the explosive growth of the terrorist Ku Klux Klan, which mushroomed to the largest size in its history. Incredibly, the Jewish Leo Frank and his multi-ethnic, multiracial saga are at the root of those signal events in black history. So why has this case become so critically important, even a century after its tragic conclusion? How has the lynching of this particular Jewish man superseded in significance the thousands of black hangings, burnings, and shootings to become the symbol of lynching in America? Why is a scrutiny of this case vital to a true and accurate understanding of racism in America? An objective and unemotional review of this forgotten tragedy will certainly result in pain for some, relief for others, but once the hidden and suppressed truths are uncovered and revealed, all will be enlightened by a fresh analysis of this fateful event in American history. Leo Frank and Mary Fagan, Predator and Prey. Quote, "It was very hard for us to be fair to him. He impressed us as a sexual pervert." End quote. Albert Lasker, Leo Frank's financier. Leo Max Frank was born in 1884 in Cuero, Texas, the son of a successful Texas merchant. At 3 months old, his folks moved to New York and raised young Leo in Brooklyn, before he went on to Cornell University and eventually obtained a degree in mechanical engineering. When offered a chance to become the superintendent of his uncle's Atlanta pencil factory in 1908, Leo Frank went south to take the position. Though raised a New Yorker, Frank possessed a legitimate Southern royal heritage. His uncle was a pro-slavery Confederate veteran. It was an honorific distinction that facilitated his acceptance into the aristocracy of Atlanta's elite community of German Jews, the well-established leaders of the Southern business world. He soon married the daughter of a prominent Jewish family and moved into his in-laws' residence. So quickly did he earn the respect of the Jews of Georgia that they elected him president of the 500-member Atlanta chapter of B'nai B'rith, the leading Jewish fraternal order in America. The National Pencil Company, then located at 37 South Forsyth Street in Atlanta, sat just about where the Sam Nunn Federal Center sits today. In 1913, the factory was part of a larger effort by American industrialists to diversify the Southern economy and expand its base beyond the one-crop, cotton, agricultural system that had for nearly three centuries made whites entirely dependent on black slave labor. But that effort sought the modernization of infrastructure without budging from the region's political, economic, and cultural obligations to white racial supremacy. Blacks were still forced to remain at the lowest rung, even as the South pushed forward to grow beyond the plantation. Leo Frank fully embraced that vision and operated his factory by the exploitative methods and practices that emerged from the slavery system. Black employees at Frank's pencil factory were paid less, limited to the rudest jobs, and confined to segregated facilities, and they faced corporal punishment if thought to be underperforming. There were white restrooms on the upper floors and a, quote, Negro toilet, end quote, in the basement. Child laborers worked long hours in primitive conditions for minuscule pay, while the enormous profits accrued to the pencil factory's owners. Anti-Defamation League attorney Dale Schwartz lamented that in Atlanta, quote, there were a lot of sweatshops that employed young teenagers at 10 cents an hour wages, and a lot of them were owned by Jewish people, end quote. Frank, quote, viewed blacks as fundamentally inferior to himself and other Southern whites, end quote, according to Dr. Stephen A. Brown. He believed, quote, that Southern black society was divided into two distinct groups. Good darkies, who could be trusted, and bad niggers, who could not, end quote. Worse, one of the company's major stockholders, the well-respected Oscar Pappenheimer, had in 1906, the same year in which whites sparked a major Atlanta riot, killing over 50 blacks, promoted Jim Crow legislation targeting all blacks in the South. Quote, I propose the registration of Negroes in the Southern states 14 years of age and more. Each person so registered should possess a certificate, in which should be entered description, date and place of birth, and, at each registration, record of abode, employment, conduct, and reference. These certificates would before long be of great value to industrious, well-behaved people. Let others decide whether it be legal to pass laws bearing on this subject with reference to the colored race only. End quote. Pappenheimer's proposal was nearly identical to that which Adolf Hitler enforced against Jews 30 years later. And in the same Hitlerian tone, Pappenheimer said he wanted his law to target, quote, trashy, thoughtless and shiftless Negroes, end quote. Frank's 10 black workers could aspire no higher than sweepers, haulers, elevator operators, furnace firemen, and night watchmen. Clearly, the National Pencil Company management saw itself as the industrial era's equivalent of a slave plantation. Industrialization brought with it the addition of white women and children to the ranks of the exploited. Leo Frank's white employees were paid pittance wages of about 7 to 10 cents an hour for a 55-hour work week, amounting on average to a weekly wage of just $4.05, the equivalent today of under $6,000 annually. Frank's employees often worked in appalling filth, and as testimony would later reveal, the more than 100 young Gentile girls were often subjected to sexual harassment and even molestation. As one Jewish scholar admitted, quote, "Frank did hire child labor, did work at disgracefully long hours at pitifully low wages. And if he did not, as popular fancy imagined, exploit his girls sexually, he walked in on their privacy with utter contempt for their dignity. Like most factory managers of his time, he was, metaphorically at least, screwing little girls like Mary Fagan." End quote. Georgia alone, among all the then 48 U.S. states, allowed factory owners to employ 10-year-old children and to work them 11-hour days, 6 days a week. The problem had become such a disgrace that in 1906, the Southern Rabbinical Association argued that, quote, "Child labor is not far removed from slave labor," end quote. When Georgians tried to address the problem with legislation, the owners of the National Pencil Company were said to have fought the measure fiercely and helped to kill it. The issue of females in the industrial workforce was also a growing concern for white Southerners. Slavery's replacement was a sharecropping system that enveloped both the black ex-slave and a fast-expanding number of poor whites. As industrialization spread, many young girls were forced into the city factories, where they worked under the unchecked control of white male managers. Their wages, meager as they were, amounted to a substantial part of Southern family income. By 1907, more than 70% of the South's female industrial workers, black and white, were under the age of 19, and they would soon make up an even larger portion of Atlanta's workforce. When Georgia politician Tom Watson spoke of female employees as being in the, quote, "possession," end quote, of their factory bosses, it struck a resentful chord in Southern white males, who watched helplessly as, quote, "progress," end quote, lowered their women into a position no different in any discernible way from that traditionally reserved for blacks. It was commonly believed that it was impossible for a female factory worker to remain a virgin. One mill owner confided that, quote, "to let a girl go into a cotton factory was to make a prostitute of her," end quote. And during slack seasons in the labor calendar, young women were even more vulnerable to sexual coercion. Watson spoke on behalf of this new exploitable labor pool when he described them as, quote, "chattel slaves of a sordid commercialism that has no milk of human kindness in its heart of stone," end quote. The mood of the city and of the time is best reflected in a 1912 report by a commission established to examine the Georgia-wide commercial prostitution of white girls and women, known as, quote, "white slavery," end quote. Quote, "The end of the battle is not yet for those girls who struggle on alone and unprotected with their more pressing financial problems. The greatest menace before her is man." The advances of men without even a spark of bravery or honor, who hunt as their unlawful prey this impoverished girl, this defenseless child of poverty, unprotected, unloved, and uncared for, as she is plunged into the swirling, seething stream of humanity. The advances of men who are so low that they have lost even a sense of sportsmanship, and who seek as their game a tired, lonely, and destitute girl. She suffers and goes down, and is finally sacrificed to a life of shame. But what of him? He escapes. It is not just, and this type of man should be severely punished. End quote. Most Southerners wanted to believe that some semblance of chivalry and honor was maintained in the sprawling Atlanta factories. But the ugly fact is that the National Pencil Company was among those businesses included in the commission's grim appraisal. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3, The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.